Welcome, deer hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science, whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere. We'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. Welcome back to Deer University. I have Steve Damaris in the room with me. And Steve, it's been a couple weeks since we last recorded a podcast, so why don't you tell everybody what you've been up to? Have you done anything fun?
Well, yes. We had, this past weekend, we had a fantastic home football game. And we, if football games had only been 50 minutes long instead of 60, we would have beat the number one team in the country, Alabama. But, you know, they play that last 10 minutes for some reason.
They're usually pretty good the last 10 minutes as well.
Yeah, they wear you out.
Yeah.
They're so, you know, their second stringers are stars on most people's teams, and they just, you know, have the depth to wear a team down. But I was so proud of our Bulldogs. And talking about Bulldogs, I'm so sorry to hear about your Bulldogs.
Yeah, that was pretty disappointing. But you know what, Steve? I care about college football. But I'm not bothered by it anymore. I've started reallocating my effort and my energy to more productive stuff. So rather than sitting around and pouting because of a football game, I get out my bow or go hunting, or most of the time we're at work, so we don't have time to pout about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how I redirect my energy now.
That's a good positive use of your energies. I had a really good hunt this past week with a friend, and it was good because I saw a deer. It was good because I had a bow in my hand. I was up in a tree.
And not on a computer.
Not on a computer. It was reasonable temperature. There were no mosquitoes.
That is nice.
It was a beautiful afternoon. The limitation was the acorns are falling on this property, and they were kind of well distributed across the property, and so it was hard to, you know, just really figure out where an individual, you know, deer was going to show up. But I did see some.
You were in a deer activity area.
Yes.
Just not close enough for a bow shot.
Yes, they were. And, you know, they come on the back side of the tree, on the other side of the slough. You back up against the slough and you think, okay, I've got everything going to be in front of me. Well, they're on the other side of the slough.
Yeah.
I hadn't, you know, done my due diligence. I didn't scout the property well enough to know, you know, to improve my chances.
So were you going on advice about kind of where to go?
Yes, I had. Okay. I was a guest and they advised me where to go, and it was a great hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Good warm up.
Well, good. I have yet to hunt. I'm embarrassed to say, and a little bit aggravated now that I think about it. That's ridiculous. Bow season has been in for over a month, and I have yet to hunt yet.
Well, we have to fix that problem, and you're getting ready to do some more travel. I know you've been traveling, and that's part of the problem.
Yeah, and the travel's been good. Most recently, I got back from Delaware, the University of Delaware, where a PhD student, Jacob Haas, successfully defended his dissertation. And so Jacob was looking at, he's looking at a whole bunch of stuff, but mainly looking at survival. So in Delaware, they're you know, trying to figure out recruitment rates of bucks and where the buck's going. So, I mean, he was looking at dispersal, yearling buck dispersal, looking at the different types of mortality relative to public hunting area or private hunting area, and a lot of things like that. And then, of course, modeling movement patterns, spatial patterns, all that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, it was a good time, and I was happy for him. He did a great job.
And yeah, you weren't just like wandering around the country looking for a place to go. You were actually asked to serve on this committee.
Yeah, surprisingly so.
Yeah.
That's right.
Because of your expertise.
Maybe so. I hope that's why it was.
And by one of our former Mississippi State University graduate students who's a professor and doing a great job up there in Delaware.
Yeah, Dr. Jacob Bowman, who we overlapped about a year or two when I was working on my PhD here at Mississippi State. So now he's a department chair at the University of Delaware in their wildlife ecology department. He's done a fantastic job.
Good whitetail work up there, and also some Sika deer work.
Yep, that's right. And the reason I'm not going to try to go hunting tomorrow is first thing in the morning I'm going to be getting on a plane going to Maine for another meeting in Maine, but this time it's going to be working for a 4-H program. So the 4-H, you know, with an extension, there's the youth program 4-H. They have a program for wildlife. So a lot of people think of a 4-H program as judging cows and judging sheep, or the, you know, I don't know, the tomato plant contest or whatever it might be, maybe. So about 20 years ago, some wildlife biologists developed a contest for wildlife habitat education. Mm-hmm. So it's called the Wildlife Habitat Education Program, or WHEP for short. And so this is the national contest, and it's administered every single year. And so I guess our listeners, if you have any youth that would be interested in that, just contact your home state extension service and learn more about the program and how you can get involved. And a few years from now, I may see those youth at a national contest someday. Mm-hmm. But that's what I'm going to be doing the next few days.
Well, good.
And it's going to be cold.
Helping young people learn about wildlife habitat, what makes good wildlife habitat.
It is a very challenging curriculum. So we're teaching kids, and a lot of it's region-specific when you're learning, but you literally learn the concepts that a freshman or sophomore that's in a wildlife biology program is going to learn. All about habitat, all about succession, all of those types of things, which animals are associated with which successional stage of habitat, and they identify that stuff. And so it's pretty amazing and pretty fulfilling when you see someone that's in 10th grade with a clipboard in their hand and they're judging, you know, habitat quality on the piece of land in front of them for deer or for a barred owl or, you know, various species. So
yeah, they don't know what they're going to be asked to judge it for when they go into the contest. Otherwise, it would be too simple.
Yeah, they have a candidate list. So there'll be about 20 species. Some are mammals, some are birds, things like that. And so they know there's a big pool of critters they need to be prepared for. Mm-hmm. And then when they get to the contest, they've never seen the site before. Here's the site. Here are the two or three species you're managing for. What would you do? And so they get real creative. They get to be a wildlife habitat biologist mm-hmm. for a day. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, we kicked around a new topic for today.
Yeah, and this is a little bit unusual for us. This is, you know, Deer University for Deer Nuts, and we're talking about hogs, feral hogs today, and that's, well, help our listeners understand why do we want to talk about feral hogs on a deer program?
Because it's a really big issue, and If you currently reside in an area with a lot of hogs, then you are already aware of the issue that it is. And if you're an area that's not plagued by hogs at the moment, you need to hear this so you can do everything within your power to stave it off, you know, to try to put it off as long as possible.
Using the word plague associated with an animal would suggest that they're pretty negative. Now, why are they so negative?
Well, I can't really think of a reason why they'd be positive. So, let's, except for generating, you know, economic revenue possibly for a few people. So if I owned a piece of land and I had a whole bunch of pigs on it that I've allowed a population to grow and expand, and I charge people to come hunt them, then that there's probably one positive for a person.
Okay.
But the negatives, you know, far, far, far outweigh that. What was your question, Steve? I got on my rant.
Oh, well, I guess before we get back on a rant, because it's an emotional topic, and as deer nuts, we understand why it's so emotional and we get passionate. So before we get passionate, let's take the listeners back a little bit. How did hogs even get here? They're a non-naturally occurring animal in the United States.
Yeah, they're not native to North America. So when we say wild hog, and there's a bunch of different names, the South especially has a bunch of different names. There's wild hog, some people say wild boar, some people say wild pig. Piney Woods rooter is even a common name in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a little known fact there. But the bottom line here, there are several different ways they got here. Now, originally, they got here through Spanish explorers, specifically Hernando de Soto. And so you can imagine the capability you have for sailing across the ocean and having an animal that you can take with you, that the reproductive rate is high, they eat just about anything. And so, you know, compared to some other animals, compared to carrying a cow, probably across the ocean, pig's pretty easy. Well, then when they got to North America, and you know, you just kind of have to piece this together, but more than likely in a lot of the different places they stopped, they probably turned some of those loose intentionally for stock, you know, for seed, so to speak, so that if they ever came back through, they might have this good source of protein. And then, obviously, along the way, too, some probably escaped, and every type of situation in there between. So that is how they first got to North America. Now, what is more common nowadays, and especially in the 21st century and into the 20th century, is people moved them intentionally. And so hunting, unfortunately, hunting plays a big role in why we have the distribution of pigs in North America that we have today. And again, you can't just say this is how it happened, because there's about every possible scenario has happened. There has literally been situations where we have feral hogs. So when we think back to the 1800s or even 1900s in some places, you know, nobody thinks about this today, but pigs were free-range managed like cattle. You know, you mark its ear, clip it, brand it, tattoo, you know, whatever you do, and you turn it loose to free-range.
Go out and collect one when you need it.
Yeah, that's right. And then, of course, if you do that enough, some are going to get away, some are going to escape, and so forth. And then in a lot of cases, and there's been a couple of these really well-known cases where hunters bring in wild boar, Eurasian wild boar or Russian wild boar, for the purpose of hunting. And so they bring them to a hunting exclosure, you know, a fenced place where they're either going to hunt them on foot or run dogs or run hounds on them. And eventually, just like with the deer, you know, eventually something's going to happen and that boar is going to escape. And so in a lot of these cases, when boars escaped, they would hybridize, breed with and hybridize with some of these domestic pigs that were managed free range.
Yeah.
So that's an example of probably what happened on the order of 100 years ago. That would be a good example. But even back then in the early 1900s, people started moving them around. One landowner heard about this landowner and they've got wild boar. Well, we want to hunt some wild boar on our property, so we ship a couple boars and a couple sows here. But then again, Steve, for 50, 60, 70 years, they were just in spots. There were pigs in Florida, there were pigs in Texas, there were pigs in California, a few in Mississippi, a few in North Carolina, and on and on. And then we have this explosion.
Before we get into the explosion, kind of help us understand, talk about Eurasian wild boar. That is a natural wild animal, native to Europe and parts of Russia.
Yeah, that's right.
And so it's not like it's a different species of animal. It is a pig, just a wild pig. And domesticated pigs came from wild pigs, so they're readily interbreedable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So the Russian wild boar, and you know, when does it become the Russian versus the Eurasian? You know, there's a lot of overlap there. That is as natural to Europe and Asia as white-tailed deer and elk are natural to North America. Animals from there, it evolved there, it's supposed to be there, it's part of their ecosystem. Now, it's still causing a whole bunch of damage over there right now because of their feeding behavior, but nonetheless, that is a natural species in the old world.
Yeah.
And that is where domestic swine came from, was from wild boar.
Okay.
Yeah, and so, yeah, they readily interbreed.
Okay, so bring us back now to current day situation. How are hogs being moved around?
So now we're getting back to the plague comment earlier.
Yeah.
So plague generally is something bad. It's usually widespread, generally. You know, got the plague, and it's usually widespread.
Hard to get rid of once you get it.
And it's hard to get rid of, yeah. The bottom line is pigs are excellent at what they do. And when I'm giving seminars, I like to challenge people for a moment, and I'll say, think for a minute, and if you had a pencil and an index card, write down a few things that you would think would be the type of animal characteristics or attributes conducive to a species becoming invasive, a species getting out of control. What are those characteristics? And those very characteristics are what pigs possess. So they can live just about anywhere. So we call them a habitat generalist. You know, I mean, and you just think right now that, you know, they live in Siberia. They now live in Canada, and they live all the way down to southern Texas and everywhere in between. So they can make it in just about any environment. A lot of animals are called this, but pigs are one of the best. It's called an opportunistic omnivore. So omnivore is going to eat plants and animals, and opportunistic meaning it eats anything.
As soon as the opportunity arises, they eat it.
If it has a calorie, it will likely consume it. I guess I have never encountered someone to say, hey, that particular animal, pigs don't eat them. I've never come across that.
Yeah.
You know, we've cut open their bellies, and there's everything from freshwater mussels to earthworms to frogs to snakes to birds. We found the remains of an armadillo in one. Whether it ate it alive or whether it scavenged it, who knows? But the bottom line is they eat anything. Okay, so they can live anywhere. They can eat just about anything. And they have a greater reproductive rate than I think any other large mammal, at least that I can think of off the top of my head. Certainly more so in North America. So a deer, Steve, as you may know this. Do you know anything about deer?
Yeah.
So I like to think of, you know, people relate that, my goodness, deer all over the place. Well, deer reproduce one time a year. And if she's in good condition and old enough, she's going to have two.
Yeah.
And very, 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 very rarely, you know, you might have a triplet. All right, so now let's compare that with a sow who could, not always, based on her age and condition, breed two times a year. And now her litter, instead of being one or two fawns, is going to be four or five or six or seven piglets.
It's a lot of reproductive potential.
Yeah, a lot of reproductive potential. And they come, females are at a breeding age, again, if in good condition, by 6 months. So they start earlier. They reproduce more often, and when they reproduce, the output is greater. So you put all that together.
It's an explosive potential.
Yeah. Hence the opportunity to be invasive. Last thing is control. So they are in a system that they did not evolve in. They are in a system, North America, where we don't have these big, large predators anymore. And that's advantageous to humans as well. But, no, you know, there's not red wolves or gray wolves to control them. We don't have a heck of a lot, even though we're seeing sightings a lot now of mountain lions or cougars, mm-hmm. Tennessee and Arkansas and places like that. But there's not enough of those to control pig populations.
Yeah.
Humans are the only control. So let me back up too, Steve. One thing is they are excellent because of all those reasons now, because of all those reasons. Once pigs are introduced to a site, that is typically why they persist and grow so well,
mm-hmm.
for all those characteristics.
Yeah. So they're successful in a lot of places, wide range of environmental conditions, temperature extremes, doesn't matter. If it's a cold place, they can survive. They can figure out a way to survive. They're good at doing what they do.
Yeah. That is the nature of the beast. Their nature is such that they can survive just about anywhere in North America as long as they have access to water.
Okay. So if you have, you mentioned, you know, hunting is really harvest by humans. It's the only way to control them potentially. And talk about the inefficiency of that relative to the need for actual control.
Let me touch on one more thing, Steve.
Sure.
Help me remember that, because that's a very important. But I don't think I clearly got to the end point of what has happened in the last 10 or 15 years.
That's right.
So I was building up that they are excellent at what they do. But the problem is pigs can make a living in just about any environment in North America, but they have to get there first. And when you start looking back at the maps, we call the distribution, animal distribution maps from 20 years ago until today, these little populations pop up all over the place, unnaturally.
You mean they didn't just walk there?
Well, we always say, you know, the saying when pigs fly, right?
Yeah.
Well, if pigs could fly, then we could say, all right, well, pigs flew from this county four counties over. Or pigs flew from northern Mississippi or southern Mississippi to Ohio. But that is how this is going. And so once you have pigs in an area, yeah, they will naturally expand outward. But these, oh my goodness, for 20 years we haven't had pigs in this county. And all of a sudden we've got pigs in this county. That's because somebody put them there for the purpose of recreational hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate that because, I mean, I really hate it, and it's really unfortunate because a lot of the non-hunting and certainly anti-hunting is going to lump people together.
Yes.
And so I'm not saying that that's hunters. I'm not saying that it's even dog hunters. A lot of people are, they enjoy hunting hogs with dogs. They're not the bad people either. These are people that enjoy hunting hogs, and they're moving them around, and they're doing it illegally. So I just want to make sure I'm not branding bad brand, that it's very, very irresponsible people.
Yeah, it's not the hog hunters per se that are the problem. It's the people that are illegally moving hogs where they don't currently exist for the purpose of promoting maybe new hunting opportunities.
Oh, yeah, and that's precisely it. That's precisely what's going on. And a lot of times when I'm talking to people or giving seminars, I can usually tell when there's someone in the audience that has taken offense by what I'm saying. And so I want to be really sure the way I'm phrasing this. So, Steve, help me make sure you're hearing it the way that I'm intending to say it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not throwing all hunters under the bus, because I'd be throwing myself under the bus. I'm not throwing all hog hunters under the bus. I'm not throwing all dog hog hunters under the bus. In every one of those groups, most, a high, high, high proportion, are ethical, and they do the right thing. But there is a segment within that hog hunting community that wants to expand their recreational opportunity. And frankly, it is downright selfish.
That's the key word. That's the word that was kind of growing in my mind while you were talking. Because when you put, it's not like you're just taking a pet dog and bringing it home to your house and enjoying that pet. It's almost, it's like having a feral dog and feral cats around, and that you feed and you don't take care of them, and they reproduce and they spread from your yard out into everybody else's yard, and they're now other people's problem. It's not just your problem.
Yeah, that's a very good analogy. That's right, and that's exactly what is happening. So we have been, Steve, I guess I should say this too. You know, when I took this job, I really had no intentions of working this much on pigs or hogs, but it has become such a need, especially in the Southeast, and it's moving north at an unfortunate rapid rate. I never knew I would be spending so much time on this, but it is affecting so many people in Mississippi and all adjacent states.
Mm-hmm. So, where are they now? Can you kind of generalize? I'm not the best recollector of geography, so can you, some broad brushstrokes about where they are in North America?
Okay, why don't I say it like this? I'm going to list states that have a healthy and thriving, and hopefully decreasing sometime soon. You know, because a lot of people, every state is engaged and hog control right now, but so let's start west with Texas, some in New Mexico, but mainly, you know, Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, and then let's go to Tennessee, and then let's keep going east until North Carolina.
Okay.
Maybe a little in Virginia, not nearly as much. A little maybe scattered in Kentucky, not nearly as much, but mainly when you go North Carolina across to Tennessee, Arkansas and into Missouri, Oklahoma, Texas, and then, of course, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Florida. That is probably, I'm pulling this number off the top of my head, but in North America, you're probably going to have 80% or 85% of the pigs are probably contained within that list of states.
Okay, but you mentioned California earlier and even Canada, so is there a big jump?
Yeah. Yeah, it occurs mainly in the Midwest. When you're in the Midwest, basically when you start getting above Oklahoma into Kansas, Nebraska, the Dakotas, the occurrences are far, far fewer. But and then you get into Canada, and there's going to be some pockets and spots of populations. New Mexico, California has had a history with pigs for, I guess, well over 100 years they've mm-hmm. been there. And then in the Northeast, there's a few, like in New Hampshire and some places like that. New York had pigs. Ohio, Indiana, you know, have all had pockets of pigs. And those are the places really where it's a lot more easier to control them. When it's just a pocket of pigs here and there, you know, control is a lot easier. When they're dominating 50, 60, 70% of the land area in your state. I hate to say the word impossible, but it's a very, very steep hill to climb.
That's what generates the emotional response in deer biologists when we when we realize how difficult this situation has become.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. And so here's some other emotion we go through, Steve. We both hunt. We both enjoy the sport of hunting. We enjoy the chase. We enjoy eating. We enjoy eating the animals that we harvest.
Mm-hmm.
Wild pigs are fun to hunt. I mean, I think so, especially if you like to bow hunt and things like that. I mean, it is truly, it's a magnificent animal. And it tastes good on top of that. So
good smoked hog.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, really good. So, I mean, you can see why it would become popular, either from, you know, stalking or stand hunting or dog hunting. I mean, it's It's a fun animal to hunt. The problem is that when you start thinking about what all they eat, there's no way, that there's just absolutely no way that when pig populations start increasing, they cannot be impacting your native game species. So why is that? Well, about half the things, at least during the fall, half the things that pigs eat are what deer eat. And the most obvious of those is, of course, acorns that was littering the place you hunted last week. So imagine if you had had, I don't know, 20, 30, 50, 100 pigs on that property. The amount of acorns that would go into a deer's mouth or a turkey's mouth or a gray squirrel's mouth has now been diminished by those pigs.
That's right.
And so you're reallocating all of that food that you were growing for wildlife and deer is now being consumed by another animal that's going to reproduce at a greater rate than the animal you care about, deer. So there's just really, and then, you know, I don't think pigs are ever regulating a deer population by consuming fawns, but that certainly occurs.
They're opportunistic.
Absolutely. So a group or a sounder of pigs is walking through, rooting through, foraging through the woods or a thicket or whatever, and they come across a fawn that's 6 days old, they're going to kill it and eat it. No question about it. Mm-hmm. So, Steve, out of 10 years of talking deer and pigs across Mississippi and other places in the Southeast, I have yet to meet a person, never not once, have I met someone that was a real enthusiast about deer hunting, deer management, or just wildlife, a wildlife enthusiast or wildlife stewardship that said, I am so glad I've got pigs on my property. Never.
Never.
Not one single time has someone raised their hand and said, I don't know what the big deal is, you know? Instead, what I always hear is, this is one of those, if I had a dollar for every time I heard this, it's, you know, 3 years ago when we saw our first pig, we thought it was, yeah, it's heck, it's kind of cool. Something else to hunt. It'd be kind of neat to see a old wild boar traipsing through the woods. And most places you can hunt them out of season, so I got a little something. And then 3 years later, they are absolutely devastated and sick of it. Because now every food plot gets rooted up. If they're doing any kind of supplemental feeding, those things are getting knocked over. Hunts get ruined. Roads get rooted up. I mean, it never ends with them.
I broke an A-frame on a pickup truck one time when one of my student workers broke the A-frame on a pickup truck driving down a dirt road on a property we were working and fell into a hog rooting hole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and talk to a farmer about what someone's recreation would do to a peanut farmer, corn farmer, rice farmer, anything, soybeans, it goes on and on. Right here in our county, Steve, we can go find farmers because I've been in the fields. They cannot even cut hay in their pasture anymore for the very reason you just described. The pastures have become so rooted up, they cannot operate their machinery on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you getting back to the emotion? Hunters get emotional, let me tell you. It's beyond emotional for a farmer.
Oh, yeah.
And their livelihoods being affected.
Talk about stories of real-life situations where farmers have attempted to plant corn. And the hogs just literally follow the row of planted corn kernels. And, you know, I've heard farmers planting 2 and 3 times repetitively, and the hogs just keep coming in, and they just root along the planting row.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My little joke about that is, you know, we're in the era of precision agriculture, and pigs are now in the era of precision rooting, because right where that planter or that drill went and precisely put that seed in the ground, they just literally root in that line along it. And so when you went from afar, when you don't know what you're looking for, when you're way back, you don't see any damage to that field whatsoever. And then you get up and you see a ditch, that's not the right word, but about the width of a pig's snout, mm-hmm. where they've gone right down and vacuumed up essentially every seed. Corn seed, by the way, now is pretty darn expensive.
Yeah, that could be devastating to the income of a farmer.
Yeah. And so, you know, everybody, I don't think there's really a commodity. I mean, I've even people that plant cotton, like, how could cotton be that palatable? I don't know if it is palatable or not, but I know they get in there in a lot of the cotton fields and also cause damage there too. So
any seed is a potentially nutritious food for a feral hog.
Could be, yeah. And so, I mean, the collection of photos I've built up over, you know, the past decade for me and other colleagues, I mean, it's just about everything. It's orchards. I mean, going in and destroying orchards, going in and destroying irrigation lines, vineyards, gardens, yards. Even in the suburbs, they get in, will root up people's yards. So, and when you really sit down and think about it, it's real. There may be an instance this is possible, but it's hard for me to imagine. When you know what a pig does for a living, and you know how it acquires food with that snout, it's hard to imagine it not causing any damage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every time it's acquiring food, especially in an agricultural environment, it's going to be causing damage. Water quality. I mean, it just goes on what the species is doing. So that's why we get so passionate. We, as ecologists and wildlife biologists, we're passionate about pigs in the other way. And that's, again, coming from someone that likes to hunt, likes to eat pigs.
Mm-hmm.
But the risk-reward ratio is just way, way, way out of balance. It's not worth it.
So suppose you are in an area that has hogs. Our listeners might be in such a place. Should they just get excited about going out and shooting some hogs and controlling the population that way?
I don't know of an instance. I don't think there's any published account. There may be some anecdotal stuff, and there's probably some people that I trust that may say that recreational harvest could decrease a pig population. You got to break that down, though, Steve. That's a big it depends.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking about hunters and recreational harvest? Or are we talking about hunting by professionals? Those are two different things, two completely different things.
Sure.
So if it's just a situation where, hey, we're going to go deer hunting, and if we happen to see a pig, shoot it, well, by all means, go right ahead. You did kill that animal or animals, and depending on the size of the property, that may end up being 20 pigs or 120 pigs. But if via recreational harvest, you're seeing and killing 120, you're still probably nowhere near what it would take to cause that population to decline.
Because they're so capable of reproducing at such a high rate.
Yeah.
I've read some modeling results that are amazing, that the percentage of a population you'd have to physically remove from a property on an annual basis to actually decrease it and keep it at a low number?
Yeah, it's over 70%. And, you know, this is stuff we've taught for years and years. We compare everything to deer. So you think about a deer population, and when you model out their reproductive effort and their survival and all that, that you can pretty much maintain a deer population by harvesting 30% of it every year.
Mm-hmm.
You can crop off 30% if it's a healthy and growing deer population. So think you have to do double that. And think how hard it is for a lot of people if a biologist were come in to say, I want y'all recreationally now, I want y'all to kill 30% of the does.
Yeah.
Man, people get tired of shooting does.
That's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. A lot of hunting. So it's a whole nother level of what you would have to do recreationally. Okay, so now the next phase would be you're going to hire some professionals, or you're going to try to behave more as a professional, and let's say you're doing the night vision and that sort of stuff, assuming that it's legal in your state, I still don't think in most cases you're going to be able to kill enough of them. And it's kind of a product of, in my mind, is once pigs are smart animals, Steve, we've talked about with deer and hunting pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in a week's time, deer can start figuring out, hey, there's something's going on in the woods. People are after me. The predator is after me to kill me. Do you not think pigs figured that kind of stuff out as well?
Sure thing.
Yeah. So they change their behavior. And so, Steve, what we recommend, and there may be a magic bullet tomorrow or 10 years from now, but right now, all things being equal, the best thing to do, the most efficient and cost-effective thing to do is trapping. Strategic trapping the right way. And when we're working with people and telling them to get engaged in a trapping program, we actually tell them, put the guns up. We don't want, we want a pig, when a pig hears a truck coming or a four-wheeler coming, we want them to think, oh, dinner time,
yeah.
Corn. We don't want them thinking, oh, I better run. That's someone with a gun that's going to shoot at me.
Yeah, because that shooter is maybe, if they're lucky, to get one out of a group of 15 running off.
Right, right.
And so you don't want to tinker away at slicing off one out of 15, one out of 14. Oh, and now they're up to 25 because of reproduction, and you one out of 25, one out of 24. It's just inefficient.
Yeah, I want that pig to associate me with the dinner bell. And literally, it can be that way. When you get these pigs trained and associated with, when that truck stops and they walk over there and they dump the bait and whatever kind of device you're using, but pour out that corn, you want to hop back in your truck and look in your rearview mirror,
mm-hmm,
and see pigs running into your trap to eat your corn.
Yeah,
that's the way you want it to work. And it's so much more efficient doing it that way.
So it's trapping, you know, okay, let's just go out and trap pigs, but there's a lot of variation in traps and how they operate. And could you help us?
Yeah.
You know, what's an optimum trap like?
For people that know traps, when I say corral trap, they'll probably know what I'm talking about. If you don't know what a corral trap is, we have a wonderful resource, kind of like we have the MSUDeerLab.com with all of our deer info. We have a website called Wild Pig Info, wildpiginfo.com, and that's got all the trapping information that you would need. But the bottom line is, we do not recommend little cage traps. We do not recommend box traps. The goal is to have a single trapping event, meaning we want the trap door to fall one time. And in that one trapping event, hopefully we're going to get 99%. We hope we get them all. Sometimes one will get away, but usually when you're doing this right, you can get 90%+ of them in that one event.
When you say of them, you're talking about a sounder or a family group?
Yeah, a group of pigs. So in terms of their social system, Steve, you know, it's a matriarchal system, just like a doe and her female offspring and her female offspring. A sounder is typically led by a matriarch sow, and there'll be several generations of those sows. And there'll be some young boars in there, but young boars disperse just like young yearling bucks disperse. So it's usually heavily female biased, except for the really young boars. And yet they travel together as a social unit, an extended family unit.
Mm-hmm.
And we endeavor to catch that entire sounder in one trapping event. Nor, when we don't, Steve, is that's when you start educating pigs to the trapping device you're using and the system you're using. Now, there you can always get second chances with some pigs. We have done that intentionally to demonstrate that, where we caught pigs and we marked them and we let them go to see if they would come back in that trap. And yeah, in some cases, in this case, they did. 3 days later, bam, they're back in the trap, and we caught them again. But all pigs aren't like that. It depends on the experience. If you, you know, it's like an old doe. I mean, think about when you're in your tree stand, you're 18 foot up, and you tell me that 6.5-year-old doe doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah.
When she gets the slight, and you try to stand up or sit and pull your butt, you know, she knows what. She knows what's going on. She's mm-hmm. smart. She's experienced.
Yeah, and especially if you have a stand and it's been in the same place for 20 years. And
yeah.
She walks out and looks right up at you.
Yeah, absolutely. Why would an old sow be any different? Her life's on the line.
That's right.
They get smart. Yeah. So that's in general, Steve. There, you know, you could spend hours talking about all these little topics, but, and, you know, toxicants. You know, they are in a review now with the EPA, and maybe a year or two from now, that may be an option, is a toxicant, meaning a bait that has a poison in it that'll kill the pig. But it's really difficult, you know, when you put a toxin on the landscape, you know, you got to target where that toxin is going. I don't want to just scatter a toxin on the landscape that every animal's going to eat.
Yeah.
I want to make sure it's going to go into a pig's stomach. I want to make sure it kills the pig effectively, quickly, humanely. And I want to make sure, and this is where your EPA and all these studies, you know, that's where you got to get into this, what happens to that toxin once the pig's dead?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, is it going to go secondarily into the ecosystem in some way?
Or some scavengers? Scavengers are going to come eat the pig.
That's right. What about if it gets a big belly full of this bait, this toxicant bait, feels bad, goes over and tips over adjacent to a tributary, a stream, and the body decomposes and, you know, that toxin gets into the water. So that's why this stuff is so difficult. Is, you know, again, since I've been doing this for 10 years, I get that question, why can't we come up with a bait or a food to kill them? That's not the problem. I mean, there's thousands of chemicals you could give a pig to kill it.
That's right.
It's doing it ecologically, responsibly, and humanely, where you don't have all the collateral damage of killing so many other animals with it.
Yeah.
That's the challenge.
You don't want to just go in and, you know, quote, nuke them.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Everything else is nuked.
Yeah. Yeah, how would you feel? I mean, just an outrageous example, but... Yeah, we got a toxicant. It's going to kill 100% of your pigs and 30 to 40% of your deer.
Yeah,
well, that wouldn't be viable.
Any black bear that are around and any coyote, you know, some people might like the idea of coyotes being killed too, but I mean, there's a lot of wildlife value that you have to protect. You can't just go out and blow up the world.
Yeah.
Trying to kill pigs.
Well, Steve, you got me on my soapbox. You got me going pretty well there.
Well, and I want to go back to one word you used specifically when you talk about hunters. You said professional hunters.
Mm.
Then you start talking about trappers and equipment. All of these things are costs versus, you know, recreational hunting. You know, you don't have to, it's not a cost to recreational hunting. But there is a cost to a landowner to hire somebody to come in and kill pigs, or to hire somebody to come in and trap, or to spend $5,000-$6,000 on a, you know, a new age trapping system that's really maybe very effective but very costly. It's easy to understand how you can get emotionally frustrated, passionate about some other person's selfishness releasing some hogs nearby because they wanted to chase some across their property, and then they've created this huge problem ecologically and financially.
Yeah, and when I think this is the most offensive word to me is when someone else's entertainment, because that's essentially they're doing that for their amusement and entertainment to mm-hmm. turn pigs loose.
Yeah.
And I like to be entertained as well because I hunt. That's fun to me. But when you're the farmer, when you're someone that's the recipient of the damage, that's kind of the way they look at it. Something you're going out there to do for fun is causing this big problem for me. And Steve, yeah, there is, our website covers this pretty well, but this new high-end trapping gear, corral traps with video surveillance and video electronically activating the door, all that stuff works. It works really, really well. But there is this extreme upfront cost. So it depends on all the bells and whistles that goes with it, but you're going to spend minimum of a couple $1,000 to get started. And if you go the very top end with every bell and whistle, you spend $10,000.
But for one trap.
For one trap with all the electronics to go in it. Yeah. And some of them even have a trailer that the trap goes on. So I'm saying that's all the bells and whistles. Mm-hmm. A completely self-contained, everything you need to go system. When a lot of people put a pencil to paper, so every situation's different, right? So let me just give you a little story. So what happens if, let's say I own two properties. I've got the property that I live on that's in my backyard, 100 acres, whatever it is. And every day it is no problem whatsoever for me to walk 300 or 400 yards away, and I'm going to check the trap, I'm going to check the trail camera, I'm going to rebait it if I need to. That's one thing. Now, what if my property, like a lot of landowners, what if your property's an hour away?
Mm-hmm.
Start adding up all the trips you start taking back and forth, back and forth. And when you start adding in your time, a lot of those traps become affordable when you discount them out over 1, 2, 3, 5 years.
Yeah.
You look like, well, heck, you know, I'm going to save myself a lot of frustration and a lot of time. And they're really good traps. I mean, you catch pigs more efficiently because you decide when to drop the door. You have a real-time look of what is in that trap. You've been watching it every day. I know I've got 10 pigs, and when that 10th one goes in, bam, hit the button, trap them. So they're very, very good, very efficient.
So there are ways to fix the problem on a very intensive basis. What about kind of a big picture? What's the future of North America and deer management and feral hogs? Is it truly a plague that's going to destroy our deer hunting traditions?
I wish you hadn't asked me that.
That's where pauses come in.
No, that is a tough one, Steve. I don't want to be discouraging.
Yeah.
I don't want anybody to say, well, heck, there's no point. We may as well throw in the towel. That's what I worry about.
Glass half empty.
Your glass half empty and glass is half full with me. Yeah, I think that pigs at some level are going to be a part of the North American landscape long after you and I are gone.
Mm-hmm.
I think most progress will be made at the local level. It's never, you know, when I'm giving seminars, I get questions from people like, what's the government going to do about this? And frankly, the government really can't do anything about it. It becomes a landowner cooperative type issue. That's brilliant. Yeah. How about that, Steve? So, and I deal with frustrated people all the time. So you've got the guy or gal that they have 50, 60, 100, 300 acres and they want to manage for mature bucks. And they say, man, I just can't do it. Every time, you know, I get a buck 3 years of age, my neighbor shoots it. And so it's very, very inefficient to try to get a mature buck on a situation like that.
Mm-hmm.
If all of your neighbors are harvesting bucks, it's hard for you to grow one to 6 years of age. Well, with pigs, it's just the opposite. You work with people that are doing the right thing. They are investing blood, sweat, tears, and money in trapping pigs, literally trapping hundreds of pigs every year, but they have no support from the people around them.
Mm-hmm.
And so pigs just keep sucking them in like a vacuum. They keep coming back. So I think our government is going to our state wildlife agency, et cetera, give us the best tools that we can have in our toolbox to be responsible. But it's going to be work for people that have pigs.
Mm-hmm.
I think even when if toxicants come on the landscape, it's not just going to be, I'm going to sprinkle a few of these poison pellets out and pigs are going to go away. There's going to be work involved with it. And so, yeah, I hate to say it, but I think in my lifetime anyway, I think pigs are going to be a part of the landscape.
So what we have to do is just stay positive. We love going out and hunting deer and hunting turkeys and squirrel, and we need to just work at identifying, you know, do we have pigs, how many, and by looking at websites like wildpiginfo.com, maybe talking to your state agency biologist, a landowner can come up with the best available information to most cost effectively address their problem.
That's right. Yeah. So I would say that every state's a little bit different, but you've got a lot of organizations. So if you're listening to this and you want to someone to come see you and talk to you face to face, start with your extension service. So you're at the county level, your extension agent. You may, of course, your state wildlife agency, call the wildlife biologist, get some info from them. Also, the USDA Wildlife Services, United States Department of Agriculture Wildlife Services, they actually offer in some states the service of trapping pigs. Now, most of that is a pay system. They have to recoup some money. But they are very, very good pig trappers. And again, it depends on state to state, but also your state Department of Agriculture as well can be a good source.
Okay. Well, Bronson, as we wrap this up, we want to stay positive.
We do.
Feral hogs are a major burr under your saddle as a deer hunter and a landowner, farmer, but we have tools to deal with them, and we need to do the best we can and manage our landscape as effectively as possible.
Yeah. And probably one of the best things you could do if you're experiencing a problem or it's just beginning, I would huddle up with my neighbors. I would call a meeting. What a great time to cook some venison and get people together and come up with a plan of attack. Spread the cost. We were talking about the cost of those traps. Well, if you had 5 landowners around you that would help out to spread the cost out, it wouldn't be as bad. But it's going to take cooperation. Yeah.
One thing we didn't touch on is the biology part here. How much of an area does a sounder or a family group cover?
It can it varies widely. And, you know, I hate we always have to compare everything to deer, but our listeners know deer. And we know deer, but it's like Steve, there's been some deer home range studies where a doe has lived and died within 300 acres, and then you've got some old buck during the rut that's covering 6,000 acres.
Mm-hmm.
For sows and those female family units, it's probably in that same ballpark. It depends on how the resources are distributed on the landscape. If a sounder of pigs, a group of pigs, has everything they need within a square mile or a square mile and a half, 1,000 acres, that's probably sufficient. Now, the difference is those big boars. And so one of our studies we have going on right now, this one particular boar, and this is in an ag landscape, so they're going long distances.
Between wood blocks. And
that's right. Cover to cover. Hey, and let me tie that back in. Coincidentally, there was an article by Lindsay Thomas in the latest Quality Whitetails, and he looked at yearling buck dispersal distances. He was kind of reviewing all the studies and found this huge trend in ag landscapes versus wooded landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the dispersal distances, you know, we never see a dispersal distance of 10 or 20 miles in the southeast. That'd be really, really rare. But in some of those, I think it was gosh, was it Illinois was maybe one of them. Those bucks were going a long ways. And what we're seeing with these boars in this ag setting is their home ranges are enormous. Tens of thousands of acres they are roaming around. And remember with a boar, they're in rut year-round.
Mm-hmm.
They're not cat. Testosterone is pumping year-round.
Yeah, because you have sows that are receptive year-round,
yep.
So they have to be.
Yeah, that's right. So movement-wise, I would say your typical sow, think of a deer, very similar to a deer's home range. But mature boar is probably going to be a lot more.
Okay. Well, I think we've covered everything but how to cook a hog.
Well done. In all seriousness, that gets in terms of trichinosis, brucellosis, and all the bad things that you can mm-hmm. get, it has to be well done. I believe the internal temperature, I'm 99% sure, the recommended is 165 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And so I no longer, when I get a piece of pig, I'm just kind of thinking sausage. I'm not going to do some type of medium rare chop or anything like that.
Yeah.
It is well done for me.
Well, and what about some safety information for the guys that are going out and shooting one?
Gloves. Make sure you wear gloves. All these diseases, brucellosis is a big one we think about unless you're consuming the meat, but all that comes, it's kind of like with a deer, you're going to get that stuff with body fluid, most notably blood. So you got a cut on your hand, and they have brucellosis. You now have an entryway for that. Reproductive fluid, of course, and then consuming it. And so then if it's in the tissue and it's not cooked well done, you consume it that way. So, you know, when I was younger, Steve, just like we all did, you know, even when I was handling pigs 20 years ago, I just naively, I would handle them without gloves.
Mm-hmm.
I do not do that now. I wear gloves to protect myself.
Yeah. And really, I do that for dressing out a deer as well.
I do that now as well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, well, good deal.
You did a pretty good interview, Steve.
Well,
how does it feel?
I'm feeling, humbled that I would be able to interview you for a change.
Oh, yeah. Well, well done.
Thank you. It's been fun.
It has been fun. I think I've talked myself hoarse here. I'm not used to talking so much, so I think my voice is about to give out. But, it was a lot of fun. And, Steve, I guess we need to powwow. We have Thanksgiving coming up, obviously. I hope we can record one more podcast before Thanksgiving, but that'll depend on my travel and your travel. But if not, we will do one right after.
Yeah, and talking about these diseases and parasites and hogs, why don't we do the next podcast on diseases and parasites of deer?
The things that your typical hunter would encounter with a deer carcass in hand. How about that?
Yeah.
All those little things we get pictures from people's phones now of. What is that? Why don't we do a podcast on that?
Sounds fantastic.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.